Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg.
Hey everybody, this is Greg with the Brothers Wiss, number 77. I'm here in the motherland, Texas, College Station to be exact. Up to my left is Captain Dave. Where are you from, Dave?
I'm from L.A. Oof. Oof. Here, this is the intro song.
Oh, my God.
Some awful song from the 90s that we love.
Oh, much like yourself. Hey, oh. Mikey. Mikey from Chicagoland. Say hi.
How's it going?
Hey. I hear all the people saying, it's going great, Mike. Thanks, dude. Let's see. Let's get all of the good stuff out of the way. Another cast sponsored by Sonart, scalable, intuitive, comprehensive ISP billing and operational support system. Learn more at sonar.software. Like I said before, in our private Slack, we do have a Sonar channel that's actually got some, I don't know that anybody's an expert on it, but we got some pretty knowledgeable guys in there. They're constantly tossing back new stuff, and when new features come out, they're discussing it. A lot of good discourse on there. I dig it. Let's see what else. New patrons. I mentioned patrons a second ago. We have a Patreon only Slack. And it's getting strong, man. A lot of good people in there. Our new patrons this week are Chad Walks, Jeff Schaefer, Rizwan Merchant, Will Deer, Damian Arangi, I think, and Chris Rushman. Yeah, sometimes I get messed up on last names. Great at first names, obviously, but it's the last ones. And that's patreon.com/thebrotherswisp. You jump in there, you become a patron, we send you an invite to the Slack, and you go bananas in there. You go ham. It's a lot of fun, a lot of great discourse, but it's all respectful. A lot of different channels. I think we make a new one probably every week and a half or 2 weeks, it seems like. I think Mike just made one that's like, I'm going to say, you guys hear my dogs going bananas in there? Mike just made one that's like residential or no. Residential electronics, something like that.
Consumer electronics.
There you go. For like your Rokus and things
CES.
Like that. So that's good. A little bit of front matter, which is fancy speak for podcast folks. It means, you know, follow up from last time. It was Michael. How do you say it? Michael DeCharme, I think, something like that. He was saying that he was watching the IPv6 podcast where we're talking about how there's no default firewall rules in V6. And he says, actually, when you enable the IPv6 package, if you look at the system default configuration print, it actually has default rules for IPv6. But the fact is that since they weren't there when it first booted up, you added the package, it's not going to put in there. But if you add the IPv6 package, tell it to reset configuration, it should pull it up in the new default. So there you go. Problem solved.
So it's kind of a catch-22 is that they have it off by default because a lot of people aren't going to use it. And, you know, if you have IPv6 enabled, it's going to be talking IPv6 to other devices. So they turn it off for security, I would assume, by default. But then because it's off, it doesn't have the default rules. So maybe they need to have some sort of trigger, like when you enable a package, it applies its default rules.
Yeah, so it at least gives you a base to work from, which I think is nice. So you can system default configuration print once you have the V6 package enabled and you can see that, or just reset. All right, so that's catch up. So we do listen. We actually do take constructive criticism and get better from it. Last podcast also, I had mentioned that we had Steve's IPv4 V6 network aggregator. It was something he whipped up from Mike. Mike was asking about it, and I had the wrong link in there. So it is the correct link you'll see in the show notes this go around. Let's see, a little bit of hardware stuff. There was a post saying Cambium's about to start doing outdoor Cat5 cable. Something that's kind of interesting, I guess. What do you guys think about that?
It's not like this is no joke cable. It's like copper shielding, all kinds of stuff. I haven't seen actual prices, just seeing the chatter in the Facebook groups. It's something that they're proud of. It's like $1 a foot.
Wow. And they're saying achieving system level 99 point, so basically 5.9s availability based on this cable. I guess that's their way of saying it's not going to fail on it.
Yet, and I know that there are vendors out there that make cable like this and that it's really expensive. I don't know what, you know, what it actually costs for some of the competitors.
Mountain, and they get strikes a lot, so they have to run fiber underground because obviously lightning or electric isn't going to burn up fiber, but Cat 5 just evaporates.
And that's kind of where I was going to go with this, is that, like, I fail to see the point for making this really expensive, really fancy cable when fiber solves the problem.
Okay. Yeah.
Like, well, I mean, like, fiber is cheaper, fiber is better, it solves the problem. Why make it?
I guess you could still use, hey, Miller. Miller from Virginia.
I'm back.
Oh, back and better. We were just talking about how Cambium announced they're going to be doing outdoor Cat 5 cable that they are super proud of. Another thing I think is interesting is it's Cat 5. Why wouldn't they just go straight to Cat 6? For whatever reason. But also people, I mean, they PoE power their radios, right? So you could, even if you're running fiber up there, I guess you could still use it to power your kit. But it seems like in most instances where people are doing fiber up, they're just running, what, some kind of Romex, some kind of power anyway?
So, do we think Cambium's going to do it badly? They have a pretty good track record, in my opinion, of doing things and bringing things to market and doing a good job at it. So it's just another example of them trying to maintain control over everything that you have for the wireless link you're doing, the wiring and the PoE and the whole king of boodle. So,
well, I see somebody here in the comments saying they got burned by the first gen Ubiquiti tough cable stuff.
Yeah.
So it makes them a little.
And it turned green.
Yeah, and started cracking and just basically sloughing off. And so a lot of people they're basically saying, you know, we're a little gun shy about beta testing somebody's new cable. So maybe we'll just wait and see. But I think you're right. Cambium does seem to be kind of the premium, in my mind, I guess, the premium vendor on stuff. And so they don't want to tarnish that reputation.
I'm just curious. Who would use? Two things. Who would use this kind of cable aside from people that are just going to be putting it underground? I mean, is there a reason why you would want to use this cable underground as opposed to, like what Hammett said, fiber or anything else?
Oh. I think this is strictly tower cable.
Yeah,
it's like not
burning up the tower.
Yeah. So it's you're buying a Cambium link and you want to make sure it works, and Cambium is not going to say, oh, what cable did you use? Yeah. You know, it's Cambium cable. You know, it's a complete Cambium solution, so you have to warrant it, you know, Cambium kind of thing. So that's what I see.
That could be interesting. Then they could start, maybe they start writing that into the warranty information. Hey, if you're not using Cambium cable, that's going to void something.
Not possibly, to say they would, or just stop them from pointing a finger at the cable, at least, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
One less thing to, well, you say that, but then if they don't install the cable right, you know, and then because it is shielded, if they don't ground it properly and things like that, then it's going to
terminate it properly you know.
Are they selling the ends too, the Cat 5 ends, the shielded ends?
I don't know. Oh, they just made kind of a media announcement about it, so all they've mentioned that I can see is the cable itself. I haven't seen anything about ends. You'd think they would have ends, right?
Because the end that you choose can make a big difference as well, you know? Pick the wrong size gauge cable for the end, then
yeah,
you know.
And as well as I've learned that in the connectors there are different styles depending on
the pins.
The solid versus stranded cable.
They're either straight or they're
pronged.
Pronged, and they dig in. Yeah.
Yeah, there's either two or some have three, depending on the cable type.
Yeah, and then some of them have metal shielding on the connector itself, and if that metal is crap, then it's going to degrade and fall apart or corrode really fast.
It if you have Ubiquiti N, sometimes not all the pins are actually in the connector. So
that could be any manufacturer, though. Come on. Well,
it could be any. I just haven't had that experience with anybody else.
By the way, what's that goop that they squirt into the connector?
Dielectric grease?
Yeah, it's like snot. It's like this thick, goopy snot. By the way, Hammett, thanks for the emoji. I love it.
It wasn't me. It has to be.
The only person that can create it is the person that started Slack.
I think it was Casey, man. Nope. I think Casey created that. The Dave Awards. There's a custom emote in there that's colon Dave colon. It's a silo in a farmhouse? Isn't that what we've agreed?
It's a lighthouse and a big rock.
There you go. Well, it is Dave, so it's not that big. All right.
Snap, and it's black.
Oh, hell in a handbasket. All right.
If you go into the customized Slack area, you can actually see who submitted each new emoji. So you can see who did it.
Shit, I thought it was you. Okay, that's cool. I appreciate it. I like it.
Since
we hear you do.
Now, for our other Slack, I did all of the juvenile emojis.
Yeah. Now we've got other people that are almost better at being juvenile than Mike. It's somewhat unbelievable.
That's good. It's good. I don't have to do it all. I don't have to carry the whole team then.
All right. So let's see. The last cast, I talked about my USB boost converter, and then I actually put together a little article and video thing. And then somebody very fervently reminded me that I need to remind people not to run this with high wattage devices. So on your laptop. So if you plug it into your laptop, you probably don't want to run your hairdryer off this thing, which is completely understandable. Most USB ports on laptops have intelligence for overcurrent protection, so they'll actually just turn the port off. But to his point, yes, absolutely. If you're going to power something high wattage, use a USB booster pack, like power pack. That way, you're isolating your important equipment away from it. And those booster packs, usually I get the... so it's spitting out 5 volts. I usually get the 2 amp guys. And so that's 10 watts you can run off a port. And a lot of times I'll use a Y cable, like on my light suits and stuff. That way you can utilize both ports. So you're looking at 20 watts you can pull out of these things. So pretty cool there. Let's see. Mike put on here RB4011 1100AH X4 BGP. What's the story on that?
So that RB4011... which has the same chip as the X4, that would actually be much, much better at BGP than the CCR. Sure. Because its cores are bigger.
Single-threaded performance would be faster on a higher CPU gigahertz count. Yeah.
Not only...
CCR is wide, this thing is tall, basically.
So... kind of put the call out there. Could somebody that has one of these check out, if you don't have BGP yourself, check out Greg's blog post he did from the last MUM on the whole BGP full route table thing. And time for us, how long it takes for these guys to pull in a full feed, what CPU is like just sitting there absorbing internet churn. I'd like to see how that performs, because that could be a great BGP router if the cheap one's $200.
I know the AHX4s are out there, so somebody could probably do it. The 4011s, I think they're supposed to hit distributors a week, maybe two, something like that.
They hit the website, so they should be soon, weeks. 1-2 weeks, whatever. But yeah, so it's the same CPU, so so somebody please try that out and let us know how long it takes and how well it does at BGP. It'd be quite interesting for MikroTik's flagship BGP router to be of 20% of the cost of the one that they meant to be the flagship router.
I'm just curious. I know that it's probably not something that should go in the, you know, like on MikroTik's webpage when they do the how many packets per second this thing can do. I mean, would it even be practical to put in, you know, different routing protocols and how fast they can load a table of some sort? Like you said, BGP. Is that something you think they should be doing, or it's completely not related to how you would benchmark a router?
I don't know. I think that's tricky for... I'm going to let Mike finish, but I think that's tricky on a couple of perspectives from them. If they were to put results on BGP convergence time on, say, like the 4011, I don't think they ever had in mind people pulling BGP tables of any, you know, of any real size on these things. So if they did that, if they put BGP results on a 4011, then they're going to get, I think in their minds, a deluge of support calls on people trying to pull full tables, and they're like tipping them over, you know? So,
but not also, all tables are going to be the same size.
Do they want to sell a whole bunch of these $180 routers that work perfectly in that scenario? Or do they want to sell the $1,000 ones? You know, so it's sort of, I don't know, from a marketing perspective, they may not necessarily want people to, you know, be pushed towards that.
What product do you think they're trying to sell here? Is it a home router? I mean, they made the one with the four antennas.
All the wireless.
It seems like it's a home, like you got a home router and then you got a Soho router. That's really what it seems to be to me, is the two things. And, you know, you don't necessarily take a full table on a Soho router or small biz router. So,
well, how many Soho routers have a 10 gig port on them, though?
Is it a 10 gig?
Yeah, there's one 10 gig. And
well, so I mean, that's interesting, because you would have a 10 gig, one 10 gig port, and then what would you do with the rest if you have to forward traffic? I mean, you'd have to, like,
so
fill all of them to get equal throughput.
So, like, one of the things I could see is that you might have an apartment complex and you run 10 gig to each floor, and then you have 10 apartments on every floor, and you can give out 1 gig to every person. Or you're trying to do 10 gig to the apartment, and you run fiber to the apartment, and you stick this router in there with this crazy Wi-Fi in there. It's like 1.7 gigabit Wi-Fi, 802.11ac, so they might be able to get it, and you could do link ag or to a desktop computer or something. So, I can see some uses for it right away.
Yeah, but definitely not data center stuff, because, you know, it doesn't have...
Well, I don't know. Say you
have one power supply. Come on.
Well, if you're... Well, you pick one power supply.
You could use probably two. One power DC barrel in the back and one PoE in. I have to look and verify, but you can...
I'm pretty sure Miller's right, so you can actually get power diversity. And if you're in the data center environment, say you're getting two redundant connections from your carrier and they're doing VRRP, then all you have is one bridge dinner or two interfaces bridged together with one default route head now, and that actually would make a really good data center, redundant data center router.
Yeah. That's exactly how I do it in my data centers.
And so then you have the 1100AH X4 that it doesn't have a 10 gig port, but it does have
two power supplies.
Yeah, it's a, you know, the, you know, dual AC power supplies.
Also got 13 port on it, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They kind of just pass through or something, right? It's like a...
If the model's off, then it'll get connectivity through it. Yeah. It's kind of... I don't know if anyone has actually used that in production.
I was going to say, I've never met anybody actually utilizing that feature set. I'm sure it's
nice
there.
As a failover,
somebody uses
but...
it.
Yeah, it's nice as a failover, but I saw it and I'm like, I'd rather use VRRP.
Well, I guess if you were doing like a bridged firewall, you know, where it was just kind of bridging through, and then if the device completely failed, then it would just hardware switch it over and it would pass. I mean, I don't know. Maybe
the truth. When does a piece of hardware with two power supplies ever just totally fail? I've never seen that.
Well, when the kernel
locks. Lightning strike.
Actually, then it doesn't turn off if it still has power. I've had an issue with a MikroTik that was bricked after a firmware update, and VRP was enabled and it was all set to fail over, but it didn't, because for some reason the switch chip was still active, but the processor wasn't. It was freaky. So,
oh, yeah.
Things don't just die. They like are halfway dead, and that's the worst scenario.
I'm looking at router OS memory usage for BGP, to see if memory would be a constraint because these only have 1 gig of RAM.
No, they'll hold it.
Yeah, and so on this one CHR I have, it has a single full feed, and it's using, with everything it's doing, it's got 600 and some odd megs of RAM used. On this other one, I'm looking at
Did Mike just admit to using a CCR for BGP?
CHR.
Yeah, get your story straight. That's how rumors get started.
That's one where I had say as to what the router is. On this other one, on this other one where I didn't have input, it is a CCR. It's got 2 gigs of RAM being consumed, but it's got 2 full feeds and a bunch of IX stuff and routes full of other stuff. Using 2, so you probably couldn't use it with a whole bunch of full feeds, but it would do one fine.
Fair enough.
I'm looking at mine right now to see what I'm using. it's using about 1.5 gigs right
now. If we're comparing Microtix, why doesn't someone just get a MaxWave? You know, it's virtualized, but it's MaxWave, yeah. So you get wild ass processor.
I got a 1072. It says total memory 11.8 gigabytes, and then free memory is 10.3.
Okay. Yeah. It's a far superior solution to a 4011, but it's also not $200.
Yeah. But if you're holding a few hundred routes, it'd be good.
I think it's a great upgrade for all those people who use 2011s at a tower, for sure. Maybe even 3011s. So this
BGP idea on a 4011 is just like a nice little test to see, or something to talk about, just to see how far you could push this.
I don't know. How many routes would you want to hold in this, Mike? Like 10,000? Is that what you want to see on a test, or you legitimately want to see what a full feed looks like on it?
Well, I mean, if it takes a full feed faster than a CCR, and if it has lower CPU because of churn than a CCR, then I see no reason why anyone would use a CCR instead of one of these.
I mean,
unless they have that many feeds that there's not enough RAM.
Well, no.
Or
I mean, think about
10 gig ports.
Well, think about everything else the router is going to be doing, right? So if you're aggregating a lot of customers, you're doing NAT, you're doing some firewall rules, you're doing all that crap, right? That's going to hit the other CPUs. So if you're doing a CCR, you've got a lot more CPUs to take care of all that other crap. So I don't know.
Well, why would you want to do all that in one router?
Do less stuff on one router.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike. We agree on
your
something.
BGP edge should only be your BGP edge.
Yeah.
And nothing else.
Gotcha. Well, yeah. I mean, Well, I'm not going to argue with you. That's exactly what I do. But a lot of these guys, you know, if all they can afford is one beefy router, then, you know, I mean, they got to do everything
but,
in there.
But now the router's only $200 instead of $1,000.
So now you spend $400 and get 2 of them?
Yeah, and then build a proper architecture.
Fair enough.
How do you do that with only one 10 gig port?
As, you know, one or possibly 2, you know, 1 gig upstreams, you know, still needs to do BGP, but, you know, is only moving a few hundred meg or, you know, maybe a gig or 2. But, you know, it's, you know, there's definitely a need for routers with bigger interfaces. Definitely need for routers bigger than $200.
I don't know.
But I think for a lot of those guys just getting into it,
they're not going to be that scale. These days, do you think most ISPs really? I'm talking about like eyeball ISPs where they just have subscribers. Do you think they really need full feed, or do they just need North America and then aggregates for European stuff?
I'll let other people provide their input, then I'll jump in.
Well, I was going to say, like, most of what I see is just, I mean, it's like 99% here in North America, and very little of it's actually overseas.
Anyone else?
Well, I was going to say...
Come on, let's hear your opinion on this, because it sounds like he's got a nice little nugget to share with us.
Well, I was going to say...
Oh, Mike, before you actually say that, Mike, I just want to point out, the poster of the pig behind you and you have the same exact skin tone. I just noticed
and,
that.
And
now.
Hair
it's really
color.
Weird.
And hair color.
And my last name is Ham. It's
snap.
And you know his ears. Now that he turns his head. Actually, match as well. The resemblance is uncanny.
Damn.
I think that you gotta take your IX routes if you have any IXs on your network for sure. And then,
which you should.
Yes, you should. And then, like, you only really need a transit provider in addition to that. So a default from them is probably the bare minimum that you would need to get away with doing it. But, I mean, full feeds are to force traffic out of your network to whichever provider to avoid asymmetric routing and steer traffic to work around bad carriers or whatever, bad paths.
Yeah.
So if you could get away without those requirements or having to do that, then you don't have to take a full feed. No.
Yeah, or you could get full feed and then just filter it, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's what I do. I have a full feed and I filter out the majority of it because I have a default and then I have a bunch of IXs. So I only have – I've got my one upstream Pixel Factory takes – pairings with other IXs and content or carriers, so directly. So.
Gotcha. And while you're mentioning,
I'm a little weird in my network. So.
While you're mentioning BGP and default routes, Andrew Thrift was talking about, and I think you had run into it before, that if you've got multiple BGP peers and you're getting default from both of them, whichever one is preferred, if you also have a floating static route, right? That's a static route with a higher administrative distance, so it's unused. If your primary BGP that's giving you default route, if that route fails, instead of using the other BGP default route, it kicks over to your static. And that could be extremely problematic because you really only want that there for like absolute emergencies. If there's, you know, your ISP is providing you one. So just be aware of that.
There's also a problem if you use check gateway ping, that can cause a lot of problems. It just doesn't activate ever, even though it might be up. So.
I never liked that check ping item because the next hop is usually alive. It's something a little bit further down that may have a cut.
So
you could get a false positive.
Yeah, it's tricky. Let's see. While we're talking about MikroTik stuff, I pulled out a few highlights from the Slack. There was so much activity in there. I just kind of scrolled through for a little bit and looked for some stuff. When you're checking CPU resources, something we've just been talking about, don't just look at the CPU utilization in your bar, right? If you have a multi-core device or if it's multi-threaded, and it's going to have more than one CPU. Well, that thing it's showing you up there is an average of all the CPUs. So say you got a 1072 and you're only showing 3% or 5% or whatever, that could be one core maxed out. So you want to go to system resources, CPU, or system resources, and then click the CPU button and it'll show all the procs and one might be getting pegged. So if you're having problems and some oddities, be sure to check in there and look at everything. And I think most people nowadays try and threshold or rather trend data, you know, like SNMP poll all of their CPUs, whatever, right?
Yeah.
Look at all the individual.
But also, there's another nice little tool in MikroTik. It's, I think it's under tool profile. Is that it? Tool profile or is it system? No, it's tool profile. And that's nice because it shows you actually all the different facilities that the MikroTik uses. So you can see different, you know, processes and which processes are bogging you down, not just the CPU itself, but see what's eating that CPU. Yeah. So that's a good idea.
Absolutely. So Jeremy was trying to figure out if he had a script running that was eating something up. And he said, if you go to system scripts jobs, you can see stuff that's actually running. Ollie says his 1036 takes about 45 seconds to reboot and start passing traffic. I don't know if he's pulling any feeds or anything, but there's kind of a quick how long it takes for something to come up. Because I always forget, you know, that moment where you're doing an upgrade or you're just having problems, so you reboot it and then you're sweating, waiting for the pings to come back.
Yes.
It's usually nice to kind of have a benchmark of how long your device takes so you don't kill yourself in the interim. Thrift was saying that the Tylera multi-core development environment, which I guess is how MikroTik builds code for those cloud cores, right? The CCRs. It only supports the 3.3 kernel. That's as far as they're going. So MikroTik's stuck at the 3.3 kernel. So if there's any features or anything like that that seem to come out for the 3.0 or anything beyond the 3.3 kernel, they're not going to be able to take advantage of it. I guess unless what? Would they have to like try and custom write something for that environment, maybe?
They'd have to do their own support for it.
Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah, and I think at that point I would just do, you know, I would just leave it behind for those, yeah, like, you know, just be like, okay, well, I mean, you know, definitely not build anything new on that platform, but then it's like, well, sorry, if you want this feature, it's not available on the season, you know, on the
problem is, like, all these people have bought these CCRs, and when, if they don't continue to support it, there's going to be all this hardware stuck on version
Like, I'm saying, like, you know, not to stop making that, but like, you know what? Okay, so you have a TCR, this is just all you're going to get. Because otherwise, they have to do kernel development. That's
pretty tough. That's pretty tough to tell your customer base that you're...
Yeah, I think that's going to be pitchforks if that happens.
I think they've already got pitchforks. It's already been 8 years since they came out with the last version of RoboOS.
The only thing that worries me about that, Mike, is there'll be a lot of people that will just keep them, right? It does what they need. And they'll have to keep releasing security updates, right? Because what happens if there's a vulnerability and they quit releasing updates? I guess you just won't get new features. Is that what you think?
Yeah. Like, you know, it's just a fork. It's like, well, you know, you just get version 699 or 650 or, you know.
I think it's probably the. I forgot what I was gonna say.
Because I mean, you know,
yeah, apparently they've legalized weed in Virginia.
They have not legalized weed.
Well, then you got no excuse. Day. No, you got no excuse. You just
can't think as much at once.
I mean, because I can only assume that doing, you know, you are the only person building for a particular architecture, doing kernel development years ago. Like, you know, everybody is still supporting mainframes. It's like, you know, you're just trying to hack stuff to make it work. When they stop supporting it.
I don't know. I don't know if there'd be pitchforks. I think a lot of people would be upset about the CCR being depreciated. But I don't know. I don't know where they go from here. Maybe use the ARM processors and just focus on those.
They should have done that 4 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I would cry about it, because think of it. I mean, how often do you refresh your routers? I mean, if you're not maxing them out, it should be every 4 or 5 years, I would say, is pushing it, right?
I don't know. That was the promise of the CCR and MikroTik, right? It's like, and the promise of MikroTik in general is you used to be landlocked, like with the traditional vendors, with what you could do because they were using so many hardware ASICs, right?
Yeah.
Just purpose built for this thing, so you only had so many buffers, you only had so much you could work with. But with MikroTik, they just release a new version, you just flash it on there, it's like magic, right? But
along this line, did you guys see that blog post about this guy who took the Edge Router and Edge Router X and loaded BSD on it and WRT on it and did performance benchmarks?
Mm-mm.
You see that?
Nah.
Did he get sued?
Not yet. No, I mean, what are they going to do? Sue BSD and for collusion?
Sure. That's just as much merit as the existing case.
Well, if they feel like it's him releasing that violates their DRM or whatever, then maybe he could get sued.
I'm going to find that article right now. It's pretty crazy because on the Edge Router X, I think WRT had the best performance. It doing almost 900 and something megabits per second through it, where the default stock firmware didn't. So,
where's Tom Smith when you need to talk about BSD?
The one time,
I mean, he's all over that.
The one time we talk
I'm
about
sure
BSD.
His ear is ringing. I'm sure his ear is like.
Oh, it's getting hot in here. It's getting hot. Someone's talking about BSD. Just don't say it 3 times in a row. We'll be okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He'll bust the monitor at us.
Was it like Beetlejuice? That kind of action?
Yeah.
He's just going to appear?
Bloody Mary or something.
Yeah, there you go. It's the worst thing that could happen. Let's see, what else? Jason Wilson shared a screenshot from the Russian mom that had a QR code. So apparently MikroTik has an iPhone app now that you can...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I got it. It's pretty awesome. And what's really cool about that is that it's pretty much all the features. And you can actually import in a WBX file. You know, you can export your config,
so is it basically
all your
WinBox
addresses. Yeah, it is WinBox on a phone, and I have it here. And I was just using it this morning because I was too lazy to get out of bed and check something. But there it is. And, dude, it works. It works, and it's wonderful.
That's cool. I wonder when they're going to do Android, because I don't do the iPhone thing.
This is Android, bro.
They did Android about 3 years ago.
Oh.
No.
Yeah.
Three years?
Two, 3 years, yeah.
I don't know. I just found it a couple of months ago because it popped up in my feed. I'm like, oh, yeah, I want that.
I think the iOS one is new, though.
Yeah, I guess the iOS
one. Oh, yeah, no. Yeah.
That's
like, iOS is definitely new, but Android's been, it's been quite some time.
Just quick note, because of all the exploits, Nick Arellano, he likes to VPN to a VPN concentrator, which all his MikroTiks connect to, and I've done the same thing, and it's been very effective because you really don't open WinBox to the internet. You're just allowing VPN traffic to access WinBox. But on my phone, I have this app that an SSTP VPN client. So first I connect to the SSTP VPN client, which connects to my, you know, CHR MikroTik in the cloud, and that's where all my MikroTiks connect. And once I'm there, once I'm connected to that, I can open the MikroTik app and just log straight into a private IP, and it works flawlessly, and I love it. So it's secure, and don't have to worry about getting whacked, and I can access it all from my phone. So it's
says
nice.
The guy from New York, get whacked.
Get whacked.
It does. So on the forum, Normus made a post July 9th, 2015, with a link to the alpha version of the Android Tik app.
Oh, there you
you
go.
Just like shitting on
Has
my
anything
day, don't
changed
you?
With the app since then? Is it still an alpha?
I had a tick app back in
2015, but it was crap. It was almost not usable. It kept crashing.
Oh yeah.
So I don't know.
Leery of the third parties who would release an app. They'd use the API or whatever. I'm like, I don't want to put my router information in some third party app that, you know.
So Dave brings up Nick. I can't pronounce his last name. Arellano,
yeah.
I always thought he was far away from me. Yeah, so I was like, I just realized that. I'm trying to, like, hire him to do stuff, and he's doing your shit for the next few months. Like, no, I got work for him to do, and he's doing stuff for you. Hiring him, and Dave's already got him booked for months. So
I don't know about for months, but that kid is bright, man. Let me tell you, he's right now still in his early phases of, I guess, being in the industry, and I've seen him already. He doesn't know this, and I keep telling him. I've already seen him surpass some of the big boys in the MikroTik circles, gotcha.
So
like the big boys.
So you're
boys.
Trying to take advantage of him while you can, is what you're saying? Young and impressionable?
No.
That's how I heard it.
He needs to realize how smart he is and how, I would say, talented in figuring out solutions to problems.
Oh, yeah, he's a sharp
really
kid.
Good at that.
Really good kid.
That's why I'm trying to hire him.
I know. I already hit him up for a little bit of help on something, too.
Nice. Yeah, that kid's going to go places, man.
All right. So let's see.
So I guess the lesson of this is that if you're really sharp, come to the Little Brothers and...
Get hired away?
All right.
Alex was trying to... Yeah, you know, Alex is hiring too out there in California.
California, yeah, he's trying to pick somebody up, and they do.
We're
cool
looking
stuff.
For people too in Richmond, but you know, is what it is.
Reach out, touch somebody. Yeah. So Dan discovered one of the little brothers. He said he was having problems with a customer whenever they connected to a Cisco AnyConnect client out somewhere else. No longer could they access resources properly. And it turns out their AnyConnect was assigning them a new DNS server. So keep that in mind next time. A quick trace route sort of sorted all the problems out. So it's amazing how I think ping and trace route are older than me. or maybe almost the same age as me, and yet that's the thing we still go to immediately.
Yeah.
Fix all the problems. All right, so something that was pseudo a thought project that Thomas, the amazing Unimus Thomas, I'll go ahead and plug Unimus, unimus.net for your backup solutions for all of your network infrastructure, as well as automated pushing out of things all at once. Is pretty neat stuff. Check it out. But he said, at what point does having services separated out bring benefit versus the all-in-one solution, right? And so this was kind of birthed from somebody asking, what syslog collector do you use? And so somebody said, like, Greylog. Somebody said they use Kiwi. And then, of course, Thomas chimed in and said, NetXMS, man, it does everything. But to that, I sort of said, yeah, but it comes at a price because NetXMS can be somewhat obtuse to start with, right? It can be a little hard to get off the ground.
The learning curve is there.
It's fairly steep. Yeah. Fairly steep.
And so then also with NetXMS syslog, it does it in a MySQL database directly, and most tools that are used to working with syslog don't have the database functionality. You know, they're used to flat files and other stuff, so it's not as easy to integrate with other features. So, like, I'm looking at some of my NetXMS syslog stuff. It's like I have to insert, like, a splitter to, you know, like a syslog proxy to say, okay, I'll take all your syslog in, dump some of it out to NetXMS, some of it out to this, some of it out to that, because I can't just get it natively from NetXMS.
But if it's in a database and they have good APIs, I know NetXMS has some good APIs, you should be able to pull it real easily.
But
if the tool you're using has that capability, if the other tool.
So at the core of the question,
okay,
in your opinions, at what point is there benefit to split out, you know, and use like a specialized solution, you know, versus an all-in-one? Obviously, an all-in-one means it's all together, right? So if you're trying to troubleshoot a problem, you've got your trending, you've got your syslog, all of your alerting is sort of all in one place. I mean, I can see value in that, right? It's only one server to maintain now, or maybe it gets bigger and you've got to split off the database over here and then you do collectors there. But
I think you just answered the question.
but then again, if you get something that just does syslog and it does it extremely well, right? Maybe it's going to give you the feature set that is best for you. Because I'm a big fan of the right tool for the right job, you know?
Get jack of all trades, master of none.
Well, you guys were saying earlier, why would you want a router that does everything, where it's doing your firewalling, your NATing, and pulling your BGP, right? You said split it out. So at what point does it make sense to split that stuff out?
There's definite value, because with having the single pane with everything integrated, you get certain synergies that you're not going to get otherwise. But then you also give up some of the specializations of the different things, unless you're going to code it in, at which point, now you have a UI nightmare. You know, how do you make the one program that does the great overview also give you all the great detail and still be able to drive it? You know, that's kind of where it's like, I like to run a generic network monitoring program, Libre or NetXMS or whatever, in addition to CN Maestro for Cambium and, Air Control for Ubiquiti and whatnot, because then they have some of those, vendor-specific things that, you don't always need it, so you don't always use it, but then, you use your main one most of the time, but when you look for something special, let's just go use this other one real quick.
Yeah. I think a lot of us, too, have limited time. You know, we have limited engineers on our team and they have limited resources. So if you've got one system to maintain, I think it's so much easier to take care of than a whole ecosystem full of systems. You know, maybe if you're a bigger organization, it would be easier for you to do that sort of thing. But if you have one system that can kind of do it all, then you could focus all of your energy and attention on it. Maybe that would be a little bit easier.
I mean, that sounds nice for simplicity and ease of management, but I mean, if all these different little apps or little monitoring programs or whatever it is that, Hammett said, if they all have good APIs, you can just pull the best parts of that info and get into an app. Yeah. I mean, seriously, that's what you would use that for. So, you know, network engineering and server stuff, that's all great, but when it comes to, when you get to a certain size, I think you have to start just, you know, custom scripting, I guess, a portal interface to get the info that you need all in one spot, even though it's coming from different programs. What do you think?
I think it's, I mean, I think it's a valid point, but you still have to have a guy that can put all that stuff together, right?
Again, yeah, at a certain size, you have to expect that and should prepare for that. I think I'm at that point where I really need the guy. You guys, it sounds like you guys need some of that too.
I use Observium and all my syslog for all my stuff goes there, so it's all kind of integrated. I can make alerts for syslogs for things. Mm-hmm. And my syslog solution's fine for me right now. I don't need to go any further, but I would like a little bit of more integration between, like, my call center and our ticketing system and, you know, that kind of stuff, and the information that they can pull from our knowledge-based site and that kind of thing.
So, yeah. Well, that's why vendors make APIs, so that you could address that directly.
Yeah.
And so, where I was looking at some of this from is that, you know, I was wanting to, and I've done this in areas with principles. I mentioned, I've actually installed the proxy, but I've looked at it and said, okay, I'm going to do that, and then haven't. But, I have set up in a smaller scale somewhat of a centralized, partially centralized fail-the-ban. You know, fail-the-ban's looking in syslog for login attempts across a variety of boxes. It's not just, watching this one server.
Yeah.
I have them dumping, they do have their syslog locally, but then they also dump it to this other VM that just does syslog, and then fail to ban watches that, and then performs, actions on the network. It SSHs into a, microtik and, drops a rule on the microtik instead of on the server.
Nice.
It just pecking different IPs throughout your range. Then you can collection.
Do you actually have it SSH out and make a drop rule, or do you have it put a null route for that single IP into your infrastructure?
I want it to do that. I haven't gotten the time to do that. But yeah, ideally I'd use something like ExaBGP or something like that to, dump a null route in. That would be ideal.
It seems like we need to come up with like some Wisp Docker repository where you just get a Docker image that does this for you. You just point stuff at it, and it's just all set up and ready to go.
With a convenient Greg is sweaty. To
yeah, Greg is getting sweaty. I think Greg's secret project might be.
Oh yet. Man,
no,
I got to do that now.
No, that's not.
But look, Microtik has an awesome API. So I don't know if you guys heard that, but Microtik has an awesome API, so you can very easily put. Like what Mike was saying, have it dump addresses into an address list that already has a rule on the server that says block or whatever. But I'm actually trying to learn PHP, and like you guys said, with what time, which is true, but you got to make time, So.
I guess on a tangent. So routing to a black hole was more resource efficient than a standard firewall drop. But since they added the raw rules, does that change it up, or is it still better than raw?
The raw still makes you lose fast path if you use it. Null routes maintain fast path.
Okay.
So understanding of the situation.
I didn't even think of that because I use raw.
Originally, I thought that raw maintained fast. I think Thrift straightened out on that part, but
yeah, he's good at that.
It does drop your fast path when you do that.
Interesting. All right, let me jump in here because Dave actually, Dave's actually got to leave here in a minute, and he had something he wanted to rant about really quick. What did you have in mind?
All right, so just recently, the reason why I asked you for data center space is because a couple things. Obviously, I need more space. I need better routes than where I'm currently at. But one of the big things is, you know, this whole net neutrality thing. It's not a myth, and it really, net neutrality really is dead, even in California, which is currently blocking it. Unfortunately, there's no one at the state level that can enforce that because that's primarily up to the FCC, which is federal. So net neutrality is killed, even in California where I am. And the way I discovered this was I had a hunch that it could have been that because I've been seeing some really strange results only with customers that were on Verizon / Frontier Network, whether it be in California or in New York or in Texas. So they were all experiencing a very strange similar problem, not call quality, but a function on the phone that was just not working. So I said, I got to dig in. I got to start, you know, sniffing packets.
Which function was it?
BLFs. So BLFs wouldn't, the SIP signal for BLF wouldn't get to the phones, that which is really odd because that's a layer 7 thing. What?
Yeah, like, that is oddly specific.
It is. It really
is. What is a BLF?
Blinking light function.
So it like emulates those old basic phone systems where it's like, you know, each line, you know, line 1, line 2, line 3, line 4, and you just push it and you were there, as opposed to a more enterprise phone system. Like those old key phone systems versus
I wouldn't say that's exactly what it is, but it does show a presence. It shows presence on a particular button, so you could program that button to be an extension or a feature or something else. But when, let's say, for example, someone's on the phone, their extension light on your phone can go from green to red. So it's not like line 1, line 2, line 3, but it's the same idea. I don't want to get into that.
Yeah, yeah.
What I wanted to say was, so that's in the SIP header, in the SIP signal, as they call it. And so I was sniffing packets of that leaving my server at the data center, and the same packet I had to catch on the receiving end of the customer's network. And what I found was that signal's been removed. And that sounds like almost like, what would we call it, conspiracy theory, but I found the smoking gun because the packet had that mark there, had that signal there when it left my servers, but didn't have that when it arrived at the customer. So that's some odd layer 7 shit. And after that, I'm like, this is totally because a net neutrality.
It would absolutely work perfectly in any network that was outside of Frontier Verizon, right?
Yeah, but that's not a good way to find out if it's that, if it's like, if that's the real problem. So obviously it's the packet sniff, checking when it leaves the data center, when it arrives at the customer, comparing those two packets and seeing what's different. And the real test was to see what happens after I VPN tunnel them to the data center, because each one of my I'd say 90% of my customers have a MikroTik. And so in the MikroTik, I just created an SSTP tunnel, so it looks like, you know, HTTPS traffic to the ISP. And after I turned that on, like, boom, immediately, everything was better. The BLFs worked. Recently, in the last week, I started getting one-way audio, which is usually you see that when you have asymmetric routes and when you have a problem with your router config, namely with SIP-ALG. But I know it wasn't that because I gave a whole presentation on SIP-ALG. some people are like, ALG, ALG, turn it off, turn it off. And I'm like, don't even go there, bro. But no, so it wasn't any of those. Occasion. So really hard to track a problem that happens on occasion without having some sort of...
You're shoving UDP into a TCP communication stream, and that might have something to do with that.
I was afraid of that too, but yeah. The nature of VoIP and any real-time protocol that cannot be buffered, i.e. VoIP, you really don't want to use TCP because you don't ever need to retransmit. But unfortunately, the MikroTik, the only VPNs that MikroTik supports are all TCP. OVPN, OpenVPN, has a UDP implementation of it, but is not supported by MikroTik. So unfortunately, I'm stuck with using TCP. And you know what? Today was the first day I've actually had customers tunneled. I have one large customer that works on a Saturday, and I called them in the morning just to say, hey, how's everything? And obviously, I tested this before I implemented it, but you know, me being nervous about just about everything, I just wanted to call and say, hey, how are things going over there? And crystal clear, the call quality sounded amazing, actually, which I don't even know. Found it, addressed it, resolved.
Don't some headsets or handsets and PBXs support encryption over through SIP, like TLS extensions on top of it?
They do, but there's still, so there's two types of encryption. VoIP can do SIP, you have your SIP messages, which can be encrypted, and your RTP stream, which can be encrypted. Obviously,
RTP is way more important.
Well, maybe not. I mean, your invites and your passwords are going to be stored in SIP headers. So ideally, you want to encrypt both, but here's the problem. They're still using, SIP is still using the same port number. TLS will use like 5061 instead of 5060. Obviously, you can make your server listen on any port you want, but the standard is that. So ISPs that are deprioritize it, or you know, throttle it, or something to screw up the connection. So even encrypting, it's not a matter of security. It's a matter of getting around the ISPs that are trying to throttle your VoIP connection. That's what it's really about.
My thought on your specific problem is someone's taking those SIP packets, deconstructing them, pulling out the audio, and putting them back together and saying I'm on the way. That's what it, if that, that's the only way I could see that flag being left out of that SIP header.
You know, I've
is if they are completely breaking apart the SIP header and putting it back together and sending it, not taking into account all the flags that are possible, only the most popular 90% or so. So
I have the packets. Well, I have the packets to compare.
Well, theoretically, what makes me wonder is if you do a trace route, it's all going to the same data center infrastructure and it's coming from the same network. So it's very likely that it's going to go from your ISP to the exact same peering point. So it's going to cut through the same router. And I know people before that have had routers to
Is Greg's been doing that the whole time, right?
Yeah. I'm having problems. Like all of my machines keep kind of zip zapping. Sorry about that.
Net neutrality. Screw.
No, but I've seen before. So if you take the same trace route, it's probably going to hit the same peering point to get into Verizon Frontier's network. And then I've heard of people before having high-end routers, like big carrier-grade routers, just do weird things to packets where they just flip a bit, like in a very specific type of packet. For whatever reason, it would flip a bit. And it could just be they were having problems on that same, you know, because it was, and I'm saying, I can't say with any certainty, but it's most likely that it's going to be going in and out of that same peering point. And maybe for whatever reason, that router has a bug and it's just flipping that bit, you know?
What if one of the routers in between those two endpoints has SIP ALG implemented on it poorly, it's not supposed to be running, and it's rewriting the packet on the fly?
Impossible, because SIP ALG only applies to NAT.
If it's a poor implementation?
No, only applies when NAT is turned on, so, and packets are being translated. That's where ALG
Are you sure all the carriers in between you and them don't have NAT turned on?
Oh God, I'm just gonna say absolutely not.
Well, it's going from your data center to like tier one carriers, right? So it seems unlikely they're gonna
like
be doing that.
It's like Fios Verizon kind of thing.
Some of the major, major broadband providers are doing CGNAT. It's not to say that, yours is in your case, but in many areas, they are doing CGNAT.
I don't even know what CGNAT is. What the hell? Oh, okay.
And it does a lot more, carrier features and things, which is just basic NAT. But
hold on. If it was, let's assume crazy that, they are using ALG. Don't know why. It is a layer 7 thing, ALG. So let's just assume that they are using that. Why ALG is designed to change addresses. Layer 7 addresses that are in the layer 7 information, like SDP and RTP headers, it's designed to change those from the whatever your NAT address is to whatever your public address is. It wouldn't even go near any of the stuff that I was experiencing. So
unless it was actually rewriting the packets from the public IP to the public IP mistakenly, not supposed to be doing that,
then you'd get one-way audio. But why would it remove a
BLF packet? The packet would go through the router and maintain the same IP information. It would be the exact same header. It would just be.
I mean, I don't know how to answer that. I really don't know how to answer that, but I think it's highly unlikely.
So I would do a trace route from all of those customers, all those affected customers to your data center, and see what the common point is. Wherever that common point is, contact that carrier and say, look, I've got packet captures, bro, where things change as soon as it hops through this router, right?
You're
not
right.
Necessarily that
you
it will,
know,
but...
you know that I've already spoken about that in the past, how in Southern California, as far as I know, only has one peer that they push traffic through. I'm sorry, Frontier only pushes traffic through one peer in Southern California. Hammett actually showed me this Atlas project where we put in the AS of Frontier down here in SoCal, Southern Cal, and we found the AS number, plugged into Atlas, and it showed that it had, like, I think, what was it, two or three peers that they have? But they
some AT&T, and then they are peered with some people on any two core sites, any two exchange down in LA. But I didn't find very many of those paths that use that.
And they must prefer somehow the peer to level 3, because I've never seen traffic from Southern Cal that anyone's on Frontier or Verizon ever traverse anywhere other than level 3.
Well, sure, so, yeah. Because it's, you know, because if your data center isn't on the any2 exchange, and they're probably not using AT&T for an upstream, because that would be ridiculous.
Yeah, they're expensive.
So,
yeah.
So then level 3 it is.
Yeah.
You sure they're not using level 3 for their VoIP carrier? Their phone line support? Like, because level 3 is a major provider
of
VoIP.
Yeah, my DIDs with them. Look, like I said, anything is really possible, but I'm strongly leaning towards the side of this whole net neutrality being screwed, because the whole reason why it started was the big boys got angry, you know, market share away from them, i.e. Netflix, Hulu. They're like, well, we can't have this. We have to lock you guys into our garbage and force you to buy it. And if not, we have to charge you or throttle you down your crap so you can't watch Netflix or make it excruciatingly painful to watch anything other than, you know, the carrier's stuff. So I think it goes in line with that.
You know what? This also makes me think of, I know an ISP, I think it was in Dallas, something like that. One of my customers was cutting through them. Anyway, they turned up a new peer, and for whatever reason, they hadn't integrated into their IDS, and it started selectively eating VPN packets. Like, it was a very specific type of VPN packet it started eating. So it was really odd.
Wasn't an MTU.
And I had to start, I mean, I had to, like, supply all kinds of evidence to these guys. And they were like, oh, yep, my bad, we fixed it. But it makes me wonder if...
you got to do their job.
Could it be, I mean, could it be something like that? You know, because it was looking at layer 7 and pulling out, like, very specific, ooh, I don't like this one.
Yeah.
Tossing it in the trash.
Very specific, you know, very, very specific. So, like I said, anything is possible. I'm not convinced that it's anything other than net neutrality. I am so curious why Hammett hasn't chimed in at all.
Well, that's interesting. So your packets actually made it. They were just, that bit was turned off in the packet that arrived.
Yeah. The signal was not there.
That's interesting, because in the IDS situation, the packets were gone. It was yanking it wasn't actually manipulating them.
What was it? I think we spoke about not too long ago a certain protocol that when it drops a packet, it doesn't even send an ICMP response. It just disappears and you don't even have any notification of it.
If you violate layer 2 MTU, that's what it does. It just disappears into the ether.
Oh, okay.
It, on a somewhat of a tangent, I knew that some companies did it, so I was trying to find it. Sangoma phones have a built-in IPsec client on the VoIP phone itself. I don't know how widespread that is in the industry. I know it's not.
There's a lot of encryption built into a lot of these handsets now. I know Polycom has it in some of the latest models.
Soma is IPsec.
Yeah, so, yeah, because I haven't seen it in other phones. You know, there's a ton of phones out there. You know, and I like to work with the phones that that just work well and work great with configuring and auto provisioning. So I'm not an expert on every phone out there, but I've never seen anything like what you just described. It would be nice. That would be really nice. I think that's something that has to be implemented shortly because of what's going on with net neutrality. Wouldn't be a bad idea. I'm going to keep saying that until Mike just explodes. Come on, Mike.
All right. I'm waiting for it, man. It's going to be 2 weeks before our next podcast. You're going to do more research. You're going to be beating up the carriers. So I wonder I wonder if you're going to hear anything back in the interim.
I'm the type of guy that just likes to handle things myself. You know it's nearly impossible.
Yeah, you do.
You know it's nearly impossible of fixing a problem myself. I know one thing. I don't like to depend on others for critical things. You know, I don't need to know everything, but I need to know enough on some areas to get things done in some sort of fashion. But I'm not going to call level 3 because you know how that's
going. No, what you have to do is you have to white paper them to death. You really have to have all of your evidence together. But I do it semi-regularly, and you get results. It takes time, though.
Yeah.
So, David,
business by the time. Yeah.
You said that Microtech doesn't support any VPNs that aren't UDP. IPsec is not UDP or TCP. Have you tried IPsec tunnel mode or anything like that?
No, I haven't. I wanted something quick and simple. Quick, simple. I don't want to have like two handshakes for every single VPN that goes out.
Yeah.
IPsec is great, but you know what? Right now, the ISPs see it as web traffic.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm happy with that. But I don't. Yeah. I would prefer not to use.
They see the stream and they can identify the stream as being VoIP because it's a constant 80K stream.
I thought the same thing.
You can actually do a lot of like white paper like. There's probably a lot of security papers out there on how you can actually pull out the information that's in the calls.
I thought the same thing, but I don't know. I was talking to Nick about it, and he's like, I don't know if the ISPs are going to go that far, you know, to actually look at
them. Even if they, I mean, they see it on port 80, but it's probably going to, if you look at the packets, you can probably.
443.
Or yeah, 443. Yeah. If you look at the packets, you can probably identify that it is SSTP traffic. But then in that respect, they'll just assume that it's VPN traffic to your corporate headquarters or something.
And plus, it won't be 88K, 80 head per packet. So
just turn on BFD as well. That'll add a little bit extra.
Yeah, I mean, I could use different codecs too, but
you're going to run a ping through just to pad it 64K or whatever?
Yeah.
That's a good idea. But well, you know what? So far it's working. I'm happy, you know, crisis averted or dealt with. Right. So I'm okay in that respect.
I have some decent contacts in level 3. So if you want to pursue this further, we can go down that rabbit hole.
Don't give a shit. I solved it.
No, you put a Band-Aid on it.
I wouldn't call that a Band-Aid. It works.
Stuck your finger in the dike. Hopefully it doesn't start splintering somewhere else that you can't reach.
Well,
nobody's going to hit that softball. All right, good deal.
I was about to, but remember we had the conversation about
that's
how right,
professionalism.
Like...
I'm so proud of you.
Yeah.
You're growing. All right, good deal.
There's some definite ingredients.
Dinguses. I regretted it the second I said it. yeah, good times. All right, so due to my internet cutting out every 15 minutes or whatever it happens to be, and that's driving me crazy because I'm gonna have to go back and do like 50 edits to chop this. I say we stick a fork in it. You guys good with that?
Almost. Yeah, I think you should totally like, you know, sniff the packets on your Skype and see if it's your internet or Skype, and then call the ISP and tell them that hey, you're screwing this. Have your white papers ready.
Well, I do a backup recording right over here with another laptop, and I'm seeing them both freeze simultaneously. So it is my upstream is having problems. Imagine that.
But, before we call it a day, I did want to say that before we meet again, Wispapalooza will have happened.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to be there. Mike will be there.
I'll be in there. Oh, nice. I fly in on Sunday around 8, and I fly out Friday at 11:30 p.m. Red eye. So,
damn.
I'll be there all week. Yeah. All
right. So,
I'm driving. And
are you guys going to? So, I know before we used to do it in just our private Slack. But in the Little Brothers with Slack, are you going to start a channel just for Vegas so all the guys there can coordinate together?
Yeah. We should just do it there, not anywhere else, because it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that way any of the listeners that happen to be there on the Slack, everybody can coordinate where everybody's at all at the same time. That'd be cool.
Yeah. I just made the conferences channel. That way we don't...
Conferences.
Yeah.
Generic.
Conferences and call it a day.
All right, easy peasy. All right, let's see. So, Dave from Pennington, if people are going to get a hold of you out on the internet, how are they going to do that?
Just send me an email, david@pennington.com.
All right, and all of your thoughts and questions and comments about net neutrality, you shoot those over to Dave. Mikey.
Carbon copy Mike.
Mikey, if people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they do that?
I'm busy. Leave me alone. All
right. He's busy. So that would be facebook.com/thebrotherswiss. That's where Mike's at. Miller, if people are going to get a hold of you, if you want people to get a hold of you, how do they do that?
Little Brother Slack channel.
Yeah. Well, Slack channel is the easiest way. I mean, I'm always on that. Always looking at that.
I had one of the little brothers send me an email and I replied on Slack and he was like, what the hell, dude? And my response was, it's the closest thing to, constant communication or real-time communication I can do on the Slack, so I like that too. If you want to find, well, also Miller, you got a blog, plug the blog.
Synstatic.net, which I haven't updated in a long time.
Doesn't matter. Oldie but goodie.
Synstatic.net. Mostly Observium setup guides that are pretty old. But
that's the last thing you've posted?
The last thing I posted was about Unimus being released, but so it's been a while.
You actually need
to go to my blog to see the Observium setup stuff, because the guys at Observium asked me if they could rip my information, my steps, and put it on their site. I give them approval to do so. So
you can
just go and get it there too. So
back when I set up an Observium VM. Yeah. I used yours versus the official because it was better. 2014.
Yeah, I basically did those at work. So I've been really busy since then. Yeah. But I have a couple of topics that I've been meaning to do. I was gonna do one on like my home lab stuff that I do. You know, the servers that I build at the house, all that fun stuff.
That's right. You in the Slack. You have a channel, pretty much.
Yeah, made a home lab channel.
Yeah, home lab channel.
Was talking about
tons of stuff in there.
The Dell R510 server that I just built with the 512 terabyte drives and ZFS, Open Media Vault, Docker build, stuff like that. Fun
That's
stuff.
Killer, man. All right, if you want to get a hold of me, gregsoul.com, email me, greg@gregsoul.com. I do some stuff on occasion. Also, the Slack, again, we'll pump it, Patreon.com/thebrotherswiss. Jump in there. Get on the Slack. It's a lot of fun. A lot of good information flowing back and forth. Again, question comments, facebook.com/thebrotherswiss. You can also hit us at contactus@thebrotherswiss.com if you're old school email style. Anything you guys run into, I think it's good commentary. It's good fodder for this stuff. I love just looking at the Slack and talking about one thing somebody happened and it turns into a 15-minute conversation. I love that for conversation starters, right? Because there's 10 ways to skin the cat and everybody in the Slack has done it a different way. So I really enjoy that. So, Questions, comments, keep them coming. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time. And start learning, lighting up the tower so people can start searching, shooting up the web in neighborhoods, net surfing. We got horrible jokes, we're loud and annoying, but we're informative facts, we're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, because fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.